We got special guest James Corbett, award-winning investigative journalist. He's host of the Corbett Report, independent, listener-supported alternative news source covering breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth to false flag terror to the police state, eugenics, geopolitics, and more. His most recent expose is a deep dive into the events of October 7th, but also he's got a great book, Reportage. I call it reportage, but you could say reportage if you want, if you're pretentious. If you're a big snooty bookworm kind of person, nerdy guy, you say reportage. James, great to see you. Thanks for coming back to the show.
Great to see you, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you're in Japan, right?
That's right.
And you feel safe there?
That's a big question. Safer than I would be in some other countries, maybe. And that's only because a lot of Japanese people can't speak a lick of English. So I'm somewhat protected by the veil of linguistic ignorance.
Do you speak Japanese?
Enough to get by. You know, I'm not super amazingly linguistically gifted in Japanese as I obviously am in English with my reportage abilities, but you know, I get by.
Now, sayonara, is that Japanese?
Yes. Yes, it is. And in fact, you know what? I'll show you the Japanese edition of reportage.
Oh, look at that. Oh, yeah. Who could read?
It's going to be all blurry, but...
Nichi senso, nichi shihai no zembo.
Wow, it looks like a...
rolls off the tongue.
It looks like they dunked a chicken claw in ink and have them
Japanese
scratch it.
Japanese books are... this looks like total nonsense to me, but I swear to God, every Japanese book looks like this. It's just...
It's like they have to draw a picture of a house with a roof every time they want to say something. Am I wrong? It's like it's all pictures. Yeah. It's like hieroglyphics almost.
Yeah, it's a full on.
How are things with the gas and oil? Because of the Strait of Hormuz and the Iran war. I hear they're not getting the oil they're supposed to. Is that true?
Well, you know, that was a big story here for a couple of weeks, and then it just kind of went away. And I guess I don't know whether they're still releasing from the reserves here or what, but it's not like gas prices are skyrocketing here. They've gone up, but they're not incredibly high yet. Presumably they're going that way, but I don't know. I don't know what jiggery pokery they're doing to try to keep things tamped down for now. But just generally, the yen is falling apart and is inflating away to nothing. So
no kidding? Why do you think that is?
A number of structural reasons. I mean, really, the question is, how did Japan manage to have such a relatively strong economy / yen for the last 30 years, despite complete stagnation of the economy? Since the bubble pop of 1990, it's just been a zombie economy with zombie banks. It got to negative inflation or negative interest at some point in the past several years. And no matter what they did, they could not get inflation going here. And that was the big mandate of the central bank. And I've been living here over two decades. And from the time I got here till about 2024, 2023, prices just did not move at all. Nothing increased in price. And now suddenly everything is increasing in price very rapidly.
Well, when energy costs more, everything costs more, right? Yep.
Exactly.
So they figured it out. Maybe they're happy that Donald Trump started this war then, maybe.
I guess so. I mean, they're happy about that kind of stuff.
I mean, Japan makes the cars. I mean, everybody loves the Japanese car. I mean, you would think they would have a kick-ass economy with the car. They make... They don't make transistor radios anymore. But what?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like everything you think about that Japan's so technologically advanced. Yeah, back in the 1980s, they were living in the year 2000. But here in 2026, they're living in the year 2000. So
really,
they have never progressed. Yeah,
they let China just blow right past them.
Yeah, wow. Maybe. And there's a whole story behind that. If people are interested, I did a report years ago on China and the New World Order about how China was specifically bolstered and set up to be the boogeyman of the 21st century, like the USSR was the boogeyman of the 20th century. The secret banking deals that they were cutting with David Rockefeller back in the 80s to start the whole boom and all of this. It's all on the record, but of course, no one's connecting the dots. But yeah, absolutely. China has been positioned to be the economic giant that it is now.
So when you say positioned by the global order?
Yes, absolutely. Which sounds crazy, right?
Like, yeah.
Oh, but they're American, right? The globalists are American. Well, no, not really. They don't have allegiance to any particular national flag. And when you look at things like the Rockefellers, they brag about their long history with China and their Chinese institutions. You look at Yale in China, which literally was the institution that propped up or that gave Mao his early start. He was an insignificant nothing when they plucked him out of the ether to start writing for their journal. But they even bragged in the Yale Daily News or whatever it was a couple of decades ago. Mao was a Yalie, essentially. He didn't go to the school, but he was propped up by them. Skull and Bones has been neck deep in Chinese ambassador posts. All of the U.S. ambassadors to China and high-level delegates to China for decades were all Skull and Bones, Yalie, CIA kind of people. There's a deep, deep history and connection there that a lot of people wouldn't know about.
So is why would the global, the Western quote-unquote global financial order want to prop up China? Is it because that they saw cheap labor and they could exploit more and make more money that way?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's not just a one particular cause. Like any sort of big machination, there's always a number of different things. So one thing that brings some of the people to the table is absolutely the cheap labor, the offshoring that has obviously made billions for certain multinational corporations. And you look obviously at something like Apple, which, you know, depends so heavily on its Chinese operations at this point that you can hardly believe, you know, that they would ever want it any other way. But I think there's more than just the monetary incentive. I think that there is a sort of broader game plan to ultimately undermine the concept of freedom and liberty in the American way, which of course was always just a concept. It was never in reality. But even that, even those ideals, even that, those platitudes, I think are anathema to the would-be controllers of humanity. So they want to build up the Chinese system as the big boogeyman that simultaneously they can point to and go, look at those horrible things that China is doing to its population. It's terrible. But then they always go, but wouldn't it be nice if we could do that over here? And you saw that obviously, most obviously during COVID, where it was like, oh, they're literally locking people in their apartments, like literally nailing boards to the door so they can't get out of their apartments, this horrible tyrannical regime. But, you know, actually, it's really effective at controlling the spread of this deadly disease. We should do it over here.
Yeah, it seems like we ape everything they do. Like, so now they have the 24-hour surveillance. So we have the flock cameras everywhere. And now we have even worse versions of flock. So they're getting rid of flock cameras, but they're replacing them. I forget what the new thing is called, but Trump is invested in it, by the way. He's invested in the company. And so, yeah, they're doing all that. And it's like, I like to say that the United States, we're like China now, except we have more street crime, homeless, and slower trains.
Yeah, exactly right. And so, I mean, I think essentially China is playing the same role as the USSR did, which was a sort of paper tiger that was propped up by the West. Look at the works of, say, Anthony Sutton, but others have done work on this before, but that was looking at the technology transfers and the economic transfers that were ongoing throughout the entire Cold War that really propped up the USSR. And in that time, of course, everything was geared towards the Red Scare, and we got to do it to take care of the Ruskies. Oh my God, they're coming for you. So we have to crack down even harder on our own citizens in order to protect you from the Ruskies. And I think it's the same thing with the Chinese boogeyman. They build up this phony paper tiger in order to scare people with it, in order to get them to give up their rights to protect us from the phony paper tiger.
And not only that, it's a perfect reason to keep spending trillions of dollars on the military industrial complex. You got to have a boogeyman.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so,
and of course, you'll notice everything that they want to do is always justified by but they, you know, we have to do it because the Chinese will get there first. Like, this is why we have to develop these autonomous AI
data center
drones. It's because the Chinese are going to do it. So we better do it first.
And that's what Kevin O'Leary, that's his go-to excuse for why we have to have data centers that take up everybody's water and pollute create climate change and all that stuff, even though I'm not a big climate change guy. But the noise pollution and the whole thing. And that's what he says. Well, China's doing it. You want to have China win? And I'm like, I don't give a shit if China wins the data center thing. Why do I care? Right? Should I care?
No.
No.
No, you should not. That is not the reason anyone should be doing anything, but it's a convenient excuse for them to tick off so many agenda items, isn't it?
There's so many things I'd like to ask you about Japan. How did Japan handle COVID? Because I remember there was a guy who was the... he was like the doctor emeritus for Chinese medicine, and he was out there, out in front in 2021 talking about ivermectin. And, you know, I showed that to people on my show, and they pretended that they didn't understand it, and they just repeated Dr. Fauci talking points. But how did Japan handle the ivermectin, the whole deal?
I want to say well in some instances, but not good in others. And of course, I mean, it comes down to the bottom line. And the bottom line is there is a big medical freedom movement here in Japan, and I've participated in rallies and protests and other things that were going on during the depths of the scandemic era. People can see reports on my site about that. But having said that, the question is what ultimately happened. And there was a lot of talk as they were starting to roll out the vaccines. There's a lot of talk about, vaccine hesitancy in Japan. Japan has been a traditionally very vaccine hesitant country, so they probably won't. But they ended up being one of the most injected populations in the world. 80%+, whatever it was, got their shots and boosters. And so the question is why? How did that happen? And I think that ultimately it comes down to the vertical tyranny that we see in places like in the United States, where tyranny is imposed top down and the government says the thing and they have their goons to enforce it in various ways. Whereas Japan is more of the horizontal tyranny, where it's the social pressure of people, basically the crabs in the bucket pulling down the other crabs as they try to escape. And so you get the point where, you know, there was never a mask mandate. There was never a law here saying that you had to wear a mask. There was never an actual lockdown or, you know, you must close your business. But there were a lot of things where, like, the Tokyo government was saying, hey, businesses, you guys should close at 9 p.m. because that's, of course, when the virus comes out.
Yeah, at night, sure.
That kind of stuff. And businesses will go along with it. And the few that question it or try to challenge it will go through the years-long legal process. And even if they're vindicated in the end, you know, you can beat the rap, you can't beat the ride kind of thing. So there was no mask mandate, but most people most of the time were masked anyway, because that's what everyone's doing. It was that kind of, you know.
So is there a rise of excess death now after all those vaccinations in Japan? Are you aware of it?
You know, good question. I don't have the latest stats, but I do know that the Japanese population is actually shrinking now. There are more deaths than births of local population. There are probably a number of factors of that. I mean, it is the demographic cake that is being baked here and has been baked for decades with incredibly low fertility rate here. But, you know, to what extent is that part of the mRNA signal? I don't know.
Have you tried the sushi?
I do occasionally have the sushi. Yes.
I hear it's better there. I don't know. I live on Sushi Row. It's hard to get better than Sushi Row here in Studio City, California. I'll be honest.
I'm from Calgary, where if you're eating sushi, there's something wrong with you. Don't eat the sushi in Calgary.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat sushi in Calgary. okay. We actually played Calgary. Or do you say Calgary? You say
Calgary.
Calgary Reportage. Okay. Ah. But some people do say Calgary, right?
Oh, probably Americans.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
No locals would say that.
We had a great show. We were at a casino somewhere in Calgary, right? Remember that? And then someone had a heart attack right in the second row, and then turns out it was just indigestion. Turned out he thought he was having a heart attack. He wasn't. But anyway, now you can imagine how much fun we had with that. All right, well, let's get to why you're really here after 25 minutes of chit-chat. That was kind of fun. Thanks for the info. What part of Japan do you live in? Do you live in Tokyo?
No, I live on the west side of the main island, about halfway between Osaka and Hiroshima, in a little town that even most Japanese people don't know. But I kind of like it that way. When I first came here, of course, I wanted to live in Tokyo or Osaka or somewhere exciting. But now that I have a family and a home, I'm happy to be out in the countryside, you know, away from the bustle.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Okay. So, you make sure your kids don't learn Japanese?
Oh, they know Japanese. Okay. Better than me, actually. Yeah, they're more fluent and they can read all those weird hieroglyphics.
So, you know, we've been surrounding China with military bases and all kinds of stuff for a long time. But as we realize now, we can't even beat Iran. Iran has won the war. And it's so it's over for us. And now it's just how bad Trump wants to let it get before he ends it. So we can't even really for real. We can't even take out China. We can't even take out Iran, let alone how could we ever go to. We're out of missiles right now. That's for real. We're out of THAADs. We're out of the JASMs and all those things. We don't have the Patriot. They're all depleted because we gave a lot of them to Ukraine, and then what was left over we gave to we shot at Iran, gave them to Israel. We're out. It's going to take you. And here's the kicker. Did you know this? You probably do. But in order to make more of those missiles and restock our ammo, we need rare earth minerals that come from China so we could then go to war with China, and China knows this, so they're not going to sell us the rare earth minerals. Are you keen to that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was a great Substack post. I can't remember the name of the Substack, but it was something like weaponizing the periodic table, where this guy went through and looked at all of these different elements and how they're used in specific, you know, military industrial processes, and how they're all sourcing basically from China. And basically how this is exactly leading us into the situation where you're going to be pooched in the event of the World War III. And this is where my mind immediately starts to go, because for people who don't know, I did a documentary years ago on the World War I conspiracy. And just between you and me and the birds, I am working on the follow-up to that, the World War II conspiracy. But it is, there's so many eerie parallels between that time and the time we're living through right now. And one of the things that people like to cite is something called the Thucydides trap, which is this theory, this observation, that whenever you have a situation where you have a dominant regional or world power that is being threatened by a rising power, exactly as the British Empire was being threatened by those darn Prussians / Germans in the turn of the 20th century, you're going to have a conflict, essentially. And so we see the dominant American Empire, and we see this rising Chinese power. Of course, it's rising because of very specific conditions, which we talked about, but we see the rising Chinese power, so there's going to be a conflict. And that, you know, the worst part of it is exactly what you have just outlined. For it's my entire life, certainly, the Americans have been the unquestioned dominant unitary superpower of the world. There has never been a military that has been more amazing and incredible and well-funded in the history of the world than the American military is right now. And they can't even secure the Strait of Hormuz, you know? Like, what is going on? And you know that to the extent that Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are really independent actors and really running their countries, and I think we have a lot of asterisks around that, but to whatever extent there are genuine, and I think there are genuine Chinese patriots and Russian patriots who are looking at that situation and going, well, now is exactly the time to do whatever we're planning to do, whether that's, you know, taking Ukraine and or taking Taiwan.
Yeah,
exactly. So so a world war, of course, is not just like every country declares war on every other country. No, it's just every country is going for whatever its strategic imperatives are. And it all happens at the same time, because the Chinese know if they're busy over in Iran, there's no way they can cover us over here in Taiwan. And Russia goes, oh, hey, now's our chance to get Ukraine, or whatever the case may be.
I mean, what the hell could we have done if they wanted to take Taiwan anyway? We can't go to war with China because China makes all our stuff, as we learned during COVID. Yeah. We can't even make masks in the United States, for F's sake. So that's the crazy thing. So the difference, I think, between World War I, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, and now the ascendant power being China, well, the businessmen who have no allegiance to the United States hollowed out our manufacturing base and our middle class, shipped it, took good jobs, shipped them to China and made them into poor jobs. And so now we can't fight it. We can't, again, we couldn't even make more missiles because they got all the rare earth minerals. So there's no way we could ever even. So this is all just posturing and goofiness and propaganda that we could somehow ever go to war with China. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah. This is what, you know, the geopolitical strategists like to talk about with regard to like the soft power of something like the American Empire. It's about the perception of this complete power that will be able to strike at any time, anywhere, and do anything it wants. And so they just get to walk around and bluster and say big words and never actually have to put anything on the table. But at the point where people start to see the emperor's not wearing any clothes, oh, hey, look, they can't even secure Iran. How are they going to do anything else? At the point that that realization starts to take hold is the point at which every actor at the table suddenly starts to realize that, oh, hey, it's all bluster. We can do this. And you're exactly right. What exactly is the U.S. going to do if China goes for Taiwan? Well, for one thing, they never say, because of course it's that strategic ambiguity. You can't possibly say what you're going to do in the event of such a thing. And the newly installed Japanese prime minister learned that the hard way last year, when she made some remarks as she was preparing to come into office, just saying something along the lines of Japan would be prepared to defend Taiwan or something along those lines if they were invaded or something like that. And that was like, oh my God, a big diplomatic incident in China severing, you know, relations with Japan and everything. How dare you say you would actually defend Taiwan? So this is the kind of ridiculous charade that's been playing out for decades. And it's the only question is, when do they stop the game of musical chairs and who's going to be sitting when they do?
And I mean, so the United States officially has a one China policy anyway, right? Where Taiwan is a part of China and it is actually a part of China, is it not?
Well, you know, since the 70s and the Nixon and the normalization of relations, I think they've gone into the, you know, ambiguity part of that. Yes, Taiwan is a thing, but you'll notice at UN and everything else, you know, remember there was a meeting of the WHO back during the COVID scandemic garbage, that there was some meeting where the Taiwanese member wanted to speak up and say something on behalf of Taiwan or something, and they had to cut him off. Because we can't officially recognize Taiwan exists as a country, because obviously right. That would upset China, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this big diplomatic dance that takes place on the world stage. That's just ridiculous.
All right. So you have recently done a deep dive into 10-7, October 7th, which, as we all know now, was could not have happened unless the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu, engineered it, which they did engineer it in many, many ways. And that's, of course, it's anti, you're a Jew hater if you say so. And you have a real knack for putting together these short videos like you did for 9/11, which I played ad nauseum on this show. I even played it for Roger Waters when he came on. And but here I want to put, so you have a new one and it's all about the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th. Was that 2023? Was that what year it was?
It was, yeah.
And so it's been almost 3 years now that they've been doing a genocide. And so let's play this, because this is really fun to watch. Let's watch.
On the morning of October 7th, 2023, approximately 6,000 Hamas soldiers flying paragliders and riding motorcycles skirted around the most heavily defended security wall in the world, somehow evading the fences, observation towers, cameras, sensors, barbed wire, and remote-controlled machine guns, dividing Israel and Gaza. These 6,000 madmen, who trained for their dastardly sneak attack in full view of the IDF for months, then proceeded to roam around the Israeli countryside for hours with complete impunity, killing hundreds of Israeli civilians and not beheading babies and not raping women while IDF forces watched, because those IDF soldiers had been ordered to stand down that morning.
All stations. I don't know why. I don't know how. Something along those lines. No patrol on the fence. What, and this was at 5:20 in the morning. All stations are to hold their positions.
Then the IDF sprung into action by implementing a policy to kill their own citizens in the event of a hostage situation. Luckily, the news anchors knew exactly what had happened within minutes.
Now, the Israeli military says this infiltration came by land, by sea, and by air in the form of Hamas gunmen on paragliders.
The U.S. Senate knew within hours.
And Iran is teamed up with Hamas, is what we are hearing.
And the Israeli government knew within the day.
Ezrachei Israel, anachu b'milchama, lo b'mivtza, lo b'sevavim, במלחמה.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists began to ask questions about the most startling security failure in the history of the most heavily defended border in the world.
So the idea that Hamas could infiltrate about 20 communities inside Israel and attack the citizens without
simultaneously
any immediate response from Israel, yeah, is extraordinary.
It is absolutely extraordinary.
Those conspiracy theorists dared to ask why the border guards were told to stand down that morning, why Unit 8200 provided no geolocation data to security forces despite Hamas fighters using phones and radios inside Israel for hours, why the IDF ignored alerts of Hamas aerial activity hours before the attack took place, and why the Prime Minister, Defense Minister, and IDF chief didn't even speak with each other until 4 hours into the crisis. But they're just anti-Semitic loons, so they would ask those questions. Even so, the IDF provided answers to all the hard questions in their comprehensive after-action report, concluding that the Israeli army had failed in its mission to protect Israeli civilians because no one could have predicted Hamas's intentions and readiness for a wide-scale surprise attack, except for the Egyptian government, Israeli military intelligence, and the IDF's own Border Defense Corps. The Northern Brigade and Gaza Division had no coordination with the police, and the IDF didn't even know the Nova Music Festival was under attack for 3 hours, but that's okay because they were probably all trying their best. The police documents about the security for the Nova Music Festival were deleted by unknown individuals months after the attacks, but that's okay because it's probably just part of routine record keeping. A Columbia Law School paper found traders informed about the coming attacks profited from these tragic events, but the original paper made a currency error that didn't affect the conclusion, so there's probably nothing to see here. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise, him, 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 and her. And her, and her, and him. After the dust settled, we were reliably informed that,
like
the false flag events of
December 7th, 1941, and
the false flag events of
September 11th, 2001, October 7th is a day that will forever live in infamy.
As a result, the Israeli forces made up for their error by gently and proportionately leveling Gaza, killing 75,000 civilians, blockading humanitarian aid, massacring people begging for food, telling people to move to areas that were then bombed, bombing hospitals that Hamas fighters were not occupying, and destroying the vast underground Hamas supervillain bunker that didn't exist. This is the story of 10-7, brought to you by the same media which told you the hard truths about the
best Biden ever,
and 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and AI-generated rat penises, and the USS Liberty. If you have any questions about this story, you are a terror-loving anti-Semitic libtard who deserves to be deported regardless of citizenship status. If you love the government of Israel and or peace, tranquility, cooperation, fresh bagels, and this adorable baby, you will never express doubts about any part of this story to anyone.
Ever.
This has been a public service announcement by the Friends of the IDF, the Epstein Influence Network, AIPAC, the ADL, the Israeli government spokespeople in the media, and the Likudniks. Because ignorance is strength.
Well done, James. As usual, that was fantastic. I just have a quick question. Let me try to see if I can find this. So who is that man?
I knew you were going to ask this, so I'm prepared. For anyone who is interested, they can go to corporatereport.com/107, this is in 10-7, and they can get the full hyperlinked transcript where I link every single thing that I'm talking about. So this man is linked, and this man is that Shalom Shatrit guy that you were talking about in that clip of talking about the stand down that happened that morning. As you were talking about on air, they got the order to not do their regular patrols that morning, as they generally do. Why? Who knows? But coincidentally, by a miraculous coincidence, that just happened to be the day of the 10-7 attack, right? So that's that guy. And every other person that was listed there never, also linked.
So let me play it, and then you can tell me.
Existed. Nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise, him, 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 and her.
Okay, so do you mind telling us who those people are? Like, who's that guy right there?
Okay, so that guy is the IDF soldier who was talking. He's caught on camera talking in the immediate wake of the attacks with bombed out building behind him. And there are reporters or people that are asking him, you know, what happened here? And he said, oh, this damage was from our tanks. And so, Israel did this? And he's like, yeah, because the Hamas fighters were blockading them, so we couldn't secure the area until everyone was gone, including, of course, the Israeli civilians that were being held hostage there, i.e. this is another angle on which we can say absolutely the Israelis killed people, killed some Israelis on 10/7. How many were killed directly by Israel? You know, we don't have that number, but we know that Israel did kill its own civilians as part of its operations that day.
And not just a few. In fact, my guess is most of the people who were killed on October 7th were killed by the IDF, the Israelis' own army, killed their own people. I mean, all those cars, they couldn't have been... So you see all these cars that are completely... like they look like the cars that were in the Maui fire, right? They look like that. And you're like, well, Hamas doesn't have that power. They don't have Apache helicopters that could, that they couldn't do that. And so everybody just shut up. And then what they did, like a few days after, like on October 10th, they buried all those cars underground so nobody could investigate. Nobody could ever ask a question about that. That really happened, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So people, so that's called the Hannibal Directive. And the Hannibal Directive is you just kill your own people if you think that they might be taken hostage, so you don't want to give them leverage. That was the whole point of that, right?
Exactly right, yeah. Because you don't want to have to deal with a hostage situation, so the best thing to do is kill the hostages, right?
And so this didn't really get reported with any kind of heft in the U.S. press or in any Western press. What do you make? Why do you think that is?
I think it's pretty obvious. Yeah, they don't want people to know or think about that because obviously it dilutes the narrative that these Hamas evil monsters are just this, you know, other species, and they are responsible for everything. But as you know, the Gray Zone was doing excellent reporting on this all during that time. And so several of the links that I have in my transcript here go back to Gray Zone reporting on that issue and others.
And so what you're alluding to is that the Western media is, as some people say, of course, only anti-Semites would say, it's Zionist occupied media, right? But my whole life, I've known that the media was biased in favor of Israel. In fact, most people were because we didn't know anything. And October 7th was when most people woke up to exactly what the whole Greater Israel Project was about, that the whole country was founded on terrorism, by terrorism, and it was given to the, but it was the Rothschilds, the bankers who helped finance World War I, the whole deal. It goes back to Jewish bankers, and then the problem with the Israel was that there were already people living there, 750,000 at least Arabs that they ethnically cleansed from there. They just killed them or massacre them or kick them out. You had to leave or get killed. And so now people know about that, but that I never heard about the Nakba until October 7th in the United States press. And so it's because the Western press is a puppet of the military industrial complex and the bankers, and CIA was set up by a bunch of Wall Street bankers and lawyers. And so that's who really runs the, so if you want to know who the deep state is really Wall Street and their bankers and a bunch of international arms dealers. I mean, that's really the deep state, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And just the latest example of that that occupied media is, of course, the Ellison family, Larry and his son David. Obviously, one of the biggest supporters, literally one of the biggest financial supporters of the IDF, civilian supporters of the IDF, Larry Ellison. And now his son is literally taking over basically every part of the media there in the United States. So, you know, again, you don't have to use a magnifying glass and, you know, go super deep into the records to find this stuff.
We'll be right back with more of this story after a brief message from our sponsor. So aging impacts everybody. I feel it in my joints. I feel it in my shoulders. I'm starting to lose my hair. You probably can't tell because I'm wearing pants. But the point is, now I'm going to be introducing Qualia Senolytic. That's the first of its kind formula designed to help your body naturally eliminate senescent cells. Senolytics are a science field revolutionizing human aging. A big culprit behind that middle-aged feeling can be senescent cells, aka zombie cells, that linger in your body after their useful function, wasting your energy and resources. The accumulation of zombie cells can lead to less energy, slower workout recovery, joint discomfort, and basically feeling old. Here's how it works. You take it just 2 days a month, helping your body naturally eliminate zombie cells to age better at the cellular level. Experience the science of feeling younger. Go to qualialife.com/door for up to 50% off your purchase and use code DORE, that's D-O-R-E, for an additional 15% off. That's qualialife.com/door. That's qualialife.com/door for an extra 15% off your purchase. Your older self will thank you. And thanks to Qualia for sponsoring this episode. Okay, so who's this next guy over here in the middle with the bald head?
Okay, so that is IDF Major General Yitzhak Brick, who blew the whistle on decades of military failures and alleged cover-ups, claiming a 2018 report warning of Israel's unpreparedness for war was deliberately hidden from political leaders. So again, more of that kind of forewarnings and foreknowledge, and we absolutely knew they were working on this, but whistleblower after whistleblower completely ignored.
So the whole idea is that Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government wanted to have a vulnerable population ordered to stand down, even though it's the most surveilled, even though Hamas was training for a year for this attack right in the open, right out like a half a mile away from the border. So they knew they were doing this. In fact, for some reason, the New York Times published the document that revealed that they knew exactly, they had all the Israeli government had all the plans that Hamas had for this October 7th. And then, of course, they were warned by Egypt and other people, warned them that this was going to happen. But there was a stand down order given and they didn't respond in a state the size of New Jersey for like, what was it, 7 hours before they finally responded? And the point was what?
Well, the point, obviously, was that they were generating the event, which was going to be the justification for what they were already planning, which, of course, was the complete leveling of Gaza. And so in order to do that, they needed the spectacular, catastrophic, catalyzing event, exactly as 9/11 was the catastrophic and catalyzing event for the war on terror, the war of terror, as I call it. This is the catastrophic and catalyzing event for the genocide of Gaza, essentially.
Yeah, so they needed this so they could use it as an excuse to go in and take over Gaza and the West Bank. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, if I could see it, anybody, I'm a C student, and if I could see it, anybody could see it. And so everybody knew it. And of course, but our government is also occupied by Zionists. Anthony Blinken, which is one of the biggest Zionists in the United States, was running Joe Biden's White House because Joe Biden was demented. And Anthony Blinken, let's remember, it's not Anthony, it's Anthony. And so he's a huge Zionist. So he was running the policy. And he's, a war criminal, is as big as they come. But what about the rest of the Western world, James? Why do you think the rest of the is it because of that every other country has their own Epstein, that they all have, that Israel and the Mossad have compromat a blackmail on everybody in the British government and the German government? And is that what's happening, is why no one will step in? Like, it seems like even the Israelis, I think it was Smotrich or Gavir, said, yeah, we're doing this and nobody's stopping us. Like, they just said it out loud. And so why do you think that no one is stopping them?
You know, again, like I said before, any sort of big major event or situation doesn't come about just for one particular reason, but certainly compromat of various sorts is something that comes into play. And I wonder what kind of compromat Israel had on Lindsey Graham. I just can't imagine what that guy had in his closet. But anyway, but obviously that's part of it. But I don't think that explains everyone and everything that's at the table here. I mean, when you look at someone like, U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, I don't think he needs to be compromised in that way. I think he genuinely believes that Israel, we just have to pledge our fealty to Israel, because he genuinely believes that that's what the Bible says and all of that. And of course, we saw, you probably saw his conversation with Tucker Carlson.
Sure, of course.
He didn't even know what scripture he was quoting or what it really said or any of that, but he just believes it because he goes along with it. He's not that intelligent. So there's people who I think genuinely believe in sort of the Zionist skew on scripture and biblical interpretation and all of that. And, I'm sure money is a factor for some people, et cetera. Again, there's a lot of reasons that people come to the table, but enough of them come to the table that this has persisted and grown in its strength and influence over the decades.
And isn't there a bit of an irony? I've also learned that it's always been a Zionist project to get the Christians to fight the Muslims, yeah, which are their enemies, and so that they hope they destroy each other.
And you know what's funny about that is both the Christians and the Muslims believe in Jesus Christ, and you know that he was a great,
yes,
the Muslims believe he was a great man or whatever. But still, you know, the people who don't believe that are the Jews. So isn't that strange? Why is it Judeo-Christian instead of, I don't know, Christian Muslim?
Yeah, well, Judeo-Christian was just a made up thing. It's not real, and that's why they. They did what's the name of that Bible that they invented? The Scofield Bible. That's right. And that was pushed. What's that? No, the Talmud is a Jewish doctrine full of craziness. But yeah, the Scofield Bible. And so they basically rewrote the Bible to make people think Judeo-Christianity is a thing. And it's not. And in fact, that the Zionist Jews they want the destruction of Christianity. In fact, when asked most recently, Benjamin Netanyahu was asked, what are you reading? And he's reading a book about the war with Rome. And they were like, he said, well, we lost the first one. We got to win the second one. Rome,
because America is Rome.
America is Rome. The West and the Christians are Rome. And so it's just, but it's also lunacy. They've come very close. Right, they've come close to bankrupting the United States and the world economy with this war with Iran, and they've got a stranglehold on all the Western governments through blackmail, and that's why we know the world is run by PDF files and the Epstein class, and where do you think now I'm aware of what the Greater Israel Project is, and as it was talked about with Mike Huckabee. And Tucker Carlson, he's like, yeah, they could have all of the Middle East. It's just it's an unbelievable idea, but it's believable because they're trying to do it. They want to parts of Syria, they got it. They want Gaza, West Bank, they got it. They want half of Lebanon, they're in the process of getting it. And in fact, they've got the Lebanese government working with them because they're also compromised. Either they're paid off or they're or both. Right, they got Epstein at blackmail or paid off, and so it's you have to almost tip your hat with how efficient their sabotage and their Mossad work is, don't you? In a sense,
in a way, even just talking about the absolute bare basic documented details makes you sound like a crazy out there person because it can't possibly all be true. What even Ahmadinejad in Iran was being recruited by Israeli intelligence? What? Are you crazy? Yeah. No, he really literally was. They were trying to reinstall him.
I did not know that. Tell me about this. What?
Yeah. So everyone remembers from back in the Bush days, Ahmadinejad, the crazy president of Iran back at that time. And, you know, he's this hardliner and all of this. And there was this brief story that came out and was briefly reported on that in one of the pictures of Ahmadinejad, he's holding up like his passport or some card that showed his original name. His original family name was Saburgian, not Ahmadinejad. And So there was this big thing about Saburgian is actually a Jewish name. And so, you know, what's going on here in all of this? Anyway, that kind of got swept under the rug. Oh, no. He's not Jewish. Don't worry about it.
Oh,
and then just a year or two ago, apparently the Israeli intelligence was working with Ahmadinejad, trying to get him reinstalled again in power in Iran to take over during, you know, after this regime change operation that they're doing there so that he could rule essentially as their proxy in the country. It just sounds so crazy, but it's completely documented now.
Okay, so let's keep going. Who's the other bald guy?
So that is, I'm not going to remember the name of the guy, but people can look up. I sourced this back to a Haaretz article about the founding of Hamas. And basically from the beginning, Hamas was essentially Israel's proxy prop up boogeyman that they would be able to use to point and say, look at all these unreasonable terrorist demons. We can't possibly negotiate with these guys. Because as you know, I'm sure, you know, Netanyahu was absolutely funding and trying to prop up Hamas as much as possible to make it seem that there was absolutely no reasonable alternative opposition there that they could possibly be negotiating with.
Yeah.
And that was true from the very beginning of Hamas. And that was one of the guys that talked about that.
So there was the PLO, which were pretty much secular and they were rational. And then so they needed people that they could call terrorists and animals. And so they funded Hamas to the tune of $30 million a month, I'm pretty sure was the number I've heard. And they were propping them up left and right, and the money was coming through Qatar. And and even the New York Times reported it, suitcases full of cash was coming from Qatar to, and Benjamin Netanyahu was facilitating that money to go to Hamas. And they would say, yeah, well, they didn't take that money and build things. They did. They took that money and built tunnels so they could kill people, right? That's what they were saying.
Yeah. And, you know, that's such an old tactic. And, you know, the British were doing that back in the Middle East, you know, the better part of a century ago, when Arab nationalism was on the rise. And you start getting these people who start talking about pan-Arab, you know, secular nationalism. No, we can't have that. So the British were working directly with the Muslim Brotherhood and things like that. I mean, this is, if people want the details on that, I did a documentary on the secret history of Al-Qaeda that goes through all of this. It's an old tactic. You got to fund the craziest part of the opposition and prop them up and make them able to do things that they would never be able to do on their own, so that you could point to them and say, that's why we have to go in and genocide this entire area.
Well, yeah, like why we had to do controlled demolitions of of the World Trade Center in Building 7 so we could point towards these guys who couldn't even pilot a plane and say, oh, no, it was Al-Qaeda who did it. By the way, now Al-Qaeda is the chief head chopper from Al-Qaeda is now the head of Syria, welcomed in open arms at the White House and in Downing Street. So so we've always been in business with Al-Qaeda. It was always a scam, and it was a scam because we have a Zionist occupied government, and they wanted to go into those, just as what General Wesley Clark told us, they wanted to go into 7 countries and take them over, and Iran's the last one on the list, and they're trying to do it, but they miscalculated with Iran badly, and they didn't realize. So let's quickly go through, who's this woman?
That is one of the whistleblowers from the Israeli intelligence who had talked about the plans that they were monitoring of Hamas working on, you know, their plans right across the border and completely ignored, of course, by the Israeli establishment.
Okay, let's see who else.
And her.
Okay, so, and same thing with her?
Efrat Fenningson, she's had me on her podcast. You should look into maybe getting her on. She talked to Brett Weinstein in the immediate aftermath of the attacks. She had experience. I can't remember exactly if she was a border guard or what, but she had experience on the border and knew, you know, not so much as a cat could approach the border fence without it being absolutely flagged and alerted within minutes, within seconds. There's no way that they had 20 different breaches of the border all in the same morning and just no one picked up on it.
And also one of the genius moves by Netanyahu was he let Hamas attack a section of Israel where the most friendly people to the Palestinians live, the most liberal people, right? Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
So he took the only resistance to Israel taking over Gaza, yeah, and he got them attacked by Hamas so that they would be on.
Right.
So it was kind of, okay.
The Nova Music Festival was this, you know, peace and harmony kind of thing, right? And the irony of that being attacked by these monstrous terrorists. Don't you see? Can't you see how horrible these people are?
Who's this?
That is Reem Al-Salem. And she is a member of the United Nations Violence Against Women and Girls or whatever, who came out and said, much to the consternation of a lot of people, no Palestinian applauded rape in Gaza. No independent investigation found that rape took place on the 7th of October.
Yeah, that was all.
And as you know, the Gray Zone did a lot of reporting on that. The fake news stories about beheaded babies and rape
women
turned out to be completely false. But, you know, the retraction is in the back of the paper and no one remembers it. But she was one of the people talking about it.
And, of course, that's Thomas Massie.
Of course.
Okay. All right. Well, James, great work, as usual. Amazing stuff. And you, of course, have
Let me put in just a quick plug. So that 5-minute, you know, funny video, as I say, it's up at corbreport.com/107 if people want the full transcript and the links and everything. But that was a sort of a follow up to a 35-minute sort of deeper dive, more serious video I did about all of this information, putting it in the tightest condensed form I could. It's called Was 10-7 a False Flag? That's up at CorbettReport.com/October7. And let me be my anti-hype man here for a second. I'm not claiming that I'm like breaking any new news here or startling new information I've uncovered. No, quite to the contrary. This is information that's just all out there. I'm just trying to put it together so that people can see it and hopefully use this as a tool to deprogram, unbrainwash the people who've been brainwashed by the Zionist propaganda.
What do you, I'm not good at predictions, but if I had to predict, because the American people finally are waking up to what the Greater Israel Project is and what it means to be a Zionist, and they're rejecting them, even when they pen, you know, to the point where El Said got won the primary in Michigan, and he was running against the Zionists, and, you know, he was outspent 11-1 with all the Zionist cash and the Jewish donors, and he still won. Now, the irony there is, I don't know if you know what the irony is, but by him winning this race, the guy who's anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, he is ensuring that the biggest Zionist in the Democratic Party, which is Chuck Schumer, will become the Senate leader. That's the irony there. So if you elect an anti-Zionist, it still props up the Zionists, and Chuck Schumer is definitely a servant to Israel. So I think the world has finally woken up, and they realize that Israel and the Zionists are the modern day Nazis. And they can't, and they're not going to be able, just like Nazis were hated worldwide after World War II for a long time, they are going to be, and they won't be able to travel unless they change their name and put a Canadian flag on their suitcase and things like that. I also predict that at some point, you're not going to be, you know, it's going to be so toxic to run as a pro-Israel candidate, which it already is, that the government of the United States might remove support from Israel. That might actually happen. And then I think Israel just collapses. And then Turkey, Iran, Egypt, and the Gulf states will just take it over. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. The narrative shift is happening. The Overton window is moving. So, yes, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime where people can now openly talk about and examine the obvious Israeli influence over, say, the U.S. government and media, etc. And it's undeniable at this point, isn't it? And as you say, like people like yourself and many others had no idea about any of this even a few years ago. But this has woken a lot of people up in the same way that 9/11 woke a lot of people up to a lot of conspiracies and things that they, like myself, that's the reason I started doing what I do. So there is sort of a bright spot in this. But there's also the danger that comes with it, because a cornered enemy is one that's going to be fighting much more viciously.
And they have nukes.
And so we can look at something like the NDAA, which is now formally merging the U.S. and Israeli military, as kind of an act of desperation, because I see it as power doesn't need to put things in writing and put things down in law when it can just act as it wants to. Because obviously the U.S. and Israeli militaries have been wedded at the hip for a very long time, and obviously the U.S. has been Israel's, you know, proxy in the Middle East to go and bomb Iraq and whoever else they wanted bombed for a long time. So why are they formalizing it in the NDAA right now? It's because they realize that public opinion is turning. They're starting to lose their influence. They're starting to get worried about that. So we better put it down in writing, make it a law so you guys can't change it and you know, double cross us. You're going to continue to support us one way or another.
Okay, jamescorbett.com. Everybody check out the longer 35-minute video. This is just a taste of it. Everybody at this show is a big fan. I'm sure all our viewers are. James Corbett, thank you again. I'll see you via Zoom at the 9/11 thing. What's it called? Turning the Tide in New York City on 9/11. Okay.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, pal. Always great to talk to you. Hey, come see me do a live celebrity panel August 30th in Burbank, California. Then stand up in New York City at Village Underground September 13th. And then in Chicago September 18, 19, and 20 in Rosemont and Chicago. Go to jimmydore.com for a link for tickets.